This is a mental game. Like, and I would show up to work thinking, what a horrible night I'm going to have. And then I started showing up to work thinking, I'm going to have a great night. Mm-hmm. And when you make that switch, the crap you deal with, hey, just put it to the side.
Yeah.
And you focus on the good stuff. And she helped me make that switch. And I tell every time I see her, I'm like, yeah, you kept me in it. You kept me in it. 13 years of education. I wish I could go back to my 19-year-old self or 18-year-old self and say, hey, screw the biology degree, get a nursing degree, and let's cut, 8 years of education out of this.
Right. Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, it's that journey. Like,
it's the journey.
You learned so much along the way.
I ended up turning my wellness practice into an aesthetic practice because people felt good when they left me. So I started doing Botox and filler and skin therapies and things like that. And really started focusing on aesthetics a couple years into that practice. Meanwhile, I have my day job at the hospital, right? I just started a business. I don't have an income from it yet. Mm-hmm. So I kept my day job at the hospital. Okay, y'all. Welcome to Nurse Stories Podcast. Today's going to be a little differently because we are going to be interviewing me and get a few of my stories. But before we go into that, let's talk about our sponsor, Five Square Aesthetics. Five Square Aesthetics has graciously sponsored this podcast. And what does Five Square Aesthetics do? They help nurses get into aesthetics by offering them a litany of service. With your membership in Five Square Aesthetics, you get a medical director, you get discounted products to inject, you get all the education you need to not only start your business, but to learn the technicalities of injecting aesthetic medications like Botox and filler. You get legal support, and you also have a social media person to help you with content creation for your social media pages. So thank you, Five Square Aesthetics. Nurses, if you want to do a side hustle in aesthetics, reach out to them. They have everything you need to get you where you want to be. So thank you. So my guest today is Nathan. Nathan is usually the man behind the camera. And because our guest had decided that they couldn't make it today, we're going to do something a little bit differently. And we are going to talk about boring old me, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
So I get a little power. I get to sit up here and kind of ask the questions that sometimes when I'm back there, I'm thinking to myself like, oh, that's interesting. And then I kind of want to prompt something. And so now being up here, being able to do that.
It's going to be fun. So Nathan's going to ask me a few questions. I have no idea where this is going to go, but we're going to have some fun with it today. So Nathan, what do you want to know?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess my first question would be just kind of like, what's your story through nursing? Like, what made you decide to be a nurse and kind of go from there?
Yeah, I wish I had a really interesting story. Like, I knew from day one that I was going to be a nurse, but that's not what happened. I went into school thinking I was going to be a dentist. And when I graduated from high school, I went to University of Idaho with a biology emphasis. Believe it or not. So I got into biology because biology degree has all the prerequisites you need to get into any kind of dental, medical, nursing kind of school, you know, from anatomy all the way through chemistries and all that. And so when I got to University of Idaho, I was a straight A student in high school. I was not a straight A student in college.
Oh, really?
Well, it's a lot different because you don't have, first of all, it's harder. Second of all, you got to have a little bit of work ethic. And I was raised on a farm, so I knew work ethic. But school had always come easy to me. And in college, you actually have to work a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so my first year, I was fine. And then my second year, I really just started getting lazy. Stopped going to classes, that kind of stuff. I actually flunked out.
Oh, really?
I did. Yeah, my last semester at University of Idaho, I flunked out. I went down to like 3 credits. And it was just like, nah, this is dumb. And so and I dropped out of school and I was like, I'm not going to go to school. And I got a job working at Papa John's delivering pizza. And I thought I was king of the world. I was making like $1,200 a month, driving around, listening to radio, just having a lot of fun. And then I realized after about 2 or 3 months of working Papa John's, I'm like, this is the most I'm ever going to make doing this. Right? Like, there's no upside to this career. What am I going to do? System manager someday? Whoop-de-doo. And so I'm like, I better go back to school. So I had to dig out of that hole because remember, I flunked up at U of I and all those credits transferred. And I went to school at Boise State University in Boise. And I had to dig out of that hole. I had to retake all those classes, got A's. I mean, my first semester back, I was like, I took it seriously. I was on the dean's list. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this right. And so I graduated in 2003 with a biology degree. And once I graduated, I applied to dental school. Now, dental school is not an easy thing to get into, especially if you have a bad semester like I did, where I flunked out, because that's kind of like a stain on you. I mean, still had a good GPA after I graduated. I was definitely on honor roll when I graduated. But 2,500 people would apply to a school with 50 positions.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they usually reserve half of those for women or minorities or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a white male in Idaho that, you know, doesn't have the best grades. I had good grades, but not the best grades. And it was really a steep climb. So I applied. A couple schools were like, yeah, you're just not going to qualify. And I'm like, well, what can I do? They're like, go get a master's degree. So I'm like, okay. So I went and got a master's degree in public health. I picked a public health program called AC, through AT Still University, and I picked that program because they had a dental school. And I'm like, okay, if I could prove myself in this master's program and I'm an alumni, I have a good chance of getting into their dental school. So halfway through my process, I applied again while I was in master's. While I was getting my master's degree, and I didn't get in. So I'm like, and by the way, every time I applied, I retook the entry exam so I can get a higher score on the entrance exam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not cheap. It's like $3,000 to apply to these things, right? Because every school has fees and you have the central application service and stuff like that. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to finish my master's program. And my master's thesis was I helped develop a water fluoridation project, which is right up dental school, right? Or right up dentistry. So I developed a water fluoridation system or a way for a small community to implement a water fluoridation system. South Carolina at the time had a grant that communities could use to implement water fluoridation systems. I worked with municipalities in South Carolina, and I developed these water fluoridation systems.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Graduated with straight A's in my master's program, and I thought, okay, now I'm a candidate. Got a degree in biology, got a master's degree in public health. I did this project for, you know, that's right up dental school alley. And then I applied a third time. My boards, I had increased my score. I was like scoring, or not my boards, my entrance exam. I was in the 90th percentile. I'm like, oh, this is great. Couldn't get in. And it was kind of debilitating because now I have this master's degree. It was 2007. I have this master degree. And I couldn't get in. So I finally like, okay, what else can I do? Like, there's nothing else I can do.
Do they give you any feedback? Like why you aren't getting in?
No, I mean, you go interview and they're like, oh yeah, great. Yeah,
it seems like it went well.
You say all the right things, you make them laugh, you know, and I think I interview well.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Not even with the alumni. Oh, and this really jaded me, by the way. My alma mater, AT Still University, and I'm not trying to call them out, They recruited somebody to meet their quotas. So you have 2,000 people applying for a program. You didn't have the right kind of applicant, you know, for their demographic they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the professors knew somebody that was a chemistry major, and they recruited this person to get into their program. And then I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, I want this. I've worked so hard at this, and you're literally going out and recruiting people? Like, this is a little ridiculous. And so that kind of jaded me in the process as well.
Yeah.
And so anyways, so now I have a master's degree in public health. Well, what happened in 2007, 2008? The economy went, right? There were no jobs. Like, I could not find a job in public health.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to one. I made it to the finals. Didn't get in because I didn't have any experience in public health, really, other than the master's degree. But what I did find was there was all of these jobs, not only in my state of Idaho, but in Oregon and surrounding states, that were public health nursing jobs. And there was a litany of them that they were trying to fill. Why? Because they pay less than normal nursing jobs. And nurses didn't want them.
Mm.
And I was talking to my wife about it. She's like, well, go get a nursing degree. And I'm like, oh, here we go again, right? I have 2 degrees. So I'm going to go get a third one. So I went back to Boise State, got into their nursing program. And by the way, getting into a nursing program when you're a white male is actually advantageous because
That's true.
They're all women,
mm-hmm.
right? So that actually helped me a little bit, I think, being a male. In fact, there was literally applications where being a white male was a minority for like scholarships and stuff. Yeah. I literally filled out scholarships where I checked the minority box because I was a male in nursing. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So I got into Boise State. It was a great education. But I kind of fell in love with the patient care. Like, I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool, which is what I wanted to do at the beginning. I picked dentistry as my career path. Mm-hmm. So nursing kind of fit that bill. And I really liked, interacting with people, learning their stories. And that's one of the reasons I started this podcast was I love stories. I love the oral tradition. I think we miss a lot of that now in society. Like, sitting down with grandpa and hearing all his cool stories, back in the day, you just don't get that much anymore because everybody's so busy. They don't have time. I mean, you don't even hang out on the porch with your neighbors anymore.
I know. It's crazy.
Right. And so I'm like, oh, let's start a nurse podcast because nurses have the best stories.
Yeah.
Right. As we are well aware.
Yeah.
So anyways, I became a nurse and we'll get into some of my stories being a nurse. And I started off as bedside and I said, hey, I got this master's degree in public health, which is very closely, the public health master's is very closely, it's very similar to like a public health administration master's. Like we took a lot of the same courses. So I had a lot of the managerial experience through that master's. I'm like, okay, I have this master's degree. I'll climb the corporate ladder. So I got hired in a local hospital. It's a bedside nurse. And I'm like, I'm going to climb this ladder. So I started joining committees and doing extra projects and things of that nature. And instantly doing that, I realized that A, bedside nursing is hard. I liked it. Very stressful, very hard. But B, corporate hospital work is not where you want to be.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And you were in the hospital too, weren't you?
Yeah.
You've worked in the hospital. What'd you do in the hospital?
I worked as in the warehouse supply management.
Oh, okay.
So it was a lot of dealing with the nurses. You know, they would call down for certain items and actually going up to their floors and kind of seeing what they're dealing with. And then also helping them in certain aspects of, finding the certain product that they need. That's what one thing I did find interesting about my job was how quickly you realize that everyone's kind of in the same boat. Like you, a lot of times you put like a doctor on a pedestal, but then when you're in that situation and they're turning to you for, they're like literally asking you like, oh, well, what product do you have for this kind of situation? And then you realize how quickly, like while that person's great at their role, like you're talking about a big hospital, everyone kind of has a special thing that they need to take care of. And they're like looked at for that resource.
Yeah. They kind of, everybody has their own expertise, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. So anyways, I got in there and I'm like, I can't do corporate. I mean, I did this big project. They had implemented a call light system in the hospital that was remote, where you can, if a call light went off, you could pick up a phone and you could talk to your patient over the intercom.
Mm.
And so they had this new capability and it was trackable and you can get data from it. And I thought, great, we can use this to speed up the call light process. Cause you may or may not know this, but they had these metrics that you had to get to a call light in a certain amount of time. I think it was 3 minutes. It wasn't 3 minutes. It was like, maybe it was 3 minutes. I don't know. There was a time. And if you picked up the phone, you answered the call light, you met that metrics, right? So I implemented this big program and we launched it and we improved call light efficiency, by, 7% and et cetera, et cetera. And they were so impressed with it that they brought me into meetings and I presented my data. And I literally was in a meeting once at the hospital and it was a meeting for the whole system. And I'm presenting and there's 60 people in the room, all managerial. And on teleconferences at all the different facilities in this hospital organization was another, let's call it 100 people. So there's like 160 people watching this. And there's more than just me. There's me and I have like 15 minutes and then it was a 2-hour long meeting and there's all these other initiatives that they're going through. So I present and we go through all these initiatives and nothing got done. We're like, oh, that's great. Move on. Oh, that's great. Move on. Oh, that's great. Move on. And I sat there as I'm realizing this is entirely inefficient. It's a waste of money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm literally looking at these people. They're all making 100 grand each or more. And I start counting and I'm like, this meeting, these people are all making $100,000 a year. I did the math in my brain and that meeting cost the organization like $4,000. And we did nothing. And I realized I can't make any changes
in this. Yeah.
And if I start climbing this ladder, I'm just going to be a bigger grunt. And then I'm going to have people telling me what to do at a higher, more stressful level. And yeah, I'll get paid more, but is that really what I want to do? So that was about a year in, maybe 2 years into my nursing adventure. And that's when I decided, no.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided to go to NP school. And so I went to Idaho State University. They just launched a doctoral program. I was the inaugural class of doctorally prepared nurse practitioners in the state of Idaho. So literally the first class that came out of state of Idaho with the doctorate behind in front of their name. And they had launched it. And because it was a doctorate, it was more tense. It had added an extra year of school to get your doctorate, more clinical hours, things of that nature, research projects, et cetera. And it dissuaded people from that would normally get into the master's program. They're like, I don't know if I want to do this. Maybe I'll go to another master's program. And at the time, this is in 2012, 2013, the nation had, the nurse practitioner associations had collectively agreed that nurse practitioners should be prepared at a doctoral level. And they had this initiative that by 2015, all schools should adopt a doctoral level for their graduating nurse practitioners. And Idaho State University took that challenge up to be you know, ready to go after 2015. What happened in the society was there's not enough doctorally prepared nurses to teach at all of the master's prepared courses. Because in order to become a doctor, you have to be taught by doctors. And most of the faculty was master prepared. So there wasn't enough. And all of these master prepared nurse practitioner schools, they literally couldn't get faculty. They weren't willing to pay a doctorally prepared nurse what they needed to get them. And so while Idaho adopted it and they had the staff, very few others converted from master's to doctoral. And so to this day, most nurse practitioners are prepared at a master's level. Some schools converted to doctoral or gave it as an option, but most of the education out there is still master's. So I made the decision 2012, 2013 to get a master's. I kept my day job as a bedside nurse, which because of all the programs and stuff I had implemented, it was pretty easy to climb up into a managerial role. And 2 or 3 years into my bedside nursing, I was in an administrative role. So I think I started off as a designated charge nurse, which turned into a nurse manager role. And I kept that until I left the hospital. Worked that full time, started my doctoral education. And then I got really lucky for my clinicals and my doctoral rotation. The VA health system has a program where you can do an internship that they actually pay you as a student. It wasn't much. It was, you know, 12, 14 bucks an hour, something like that. But I got to do a year clinical rotation with the VA health system as a paid employee instead of just doing it for free, because most of your clinical work is done free as a preceptor. So, but it was also hard because I was a manager I wasn't on salary, but I had pretty high demands on my time. I think I was doing 40 hours a week, which is not what you should do. You should not be working full time if you're going to a doctoral nurse practitioner program. It was exhausting. Like, I'm getting PTSD just talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I have projects to do. So, and I have this part-time job at the VA and a 40-hour job at the hospital, and I have to get my hours done. And I remember, I mean, it was 16-hour days there for a couple of years, literally year-round, except for Sunday afternoons, I got 4 hours off. And that was family time. So my wife, luckily, she wasn't working. She just stayed at home with the kids and raised the kids. And that's how we got through it. But I can't tell you how many days I wanted to quit. And I told my wife, I'm like, I'm done. Like, this isn't worth it. I got a good job, I'm making good money. Why am I doing this to myself? And we had little kids at the time. Then we watched all the Pixar movies, and she would say, just keep swimming. Just keep swimming.
Yeah.
And I just kept swimming. And the last semester was the most stressful thing because I had to present my doctoral project, which I had done. It was an education module in oral cancer screening, implementing oral cancer screening in primary care, which isn't done. To this day, it's not done. So I developed this huge education module to get providers the education they needed to do oral cancer screening in primary care. And I had to present to my peers, which were doctorally prepared nurses in the public. And so They call it a thesis defense. And so they pulled me into the room and I have to present this. And I was just beyond terrified, because you're kind of, these things are kind of notorious where you get picked apart on your research and they find data and they ask you to explain the data and all this kind of stuff. And so I start presenting. Well, the level of work I had done, I mean, remember, I've written like a 60-page paper at this point on this project. The level of work I have done, I realized there's no one else on Earth that knows this material more than I do.
So it gave you that confidence.
I didn't have that confidence until I was like 5 or 10 minutes into my presentation, and I saw everybody going, I don't understand. Like,
oh, it started hitting you?
Well, they were like, okay, I think I understand what he's saying. But I was at such a high level.
Yeah.
They were like, okay, yeah. They're just smiling and nodding like, okay, yeah. And I'm like, oh, I know more than these people do.
Mm-hmm.
So that defense went on for about an hour and a half. I wowed them, very few questions afterwards. And then they said, hey, congratulations, Dr. McCray. And I'm like, sweet, graduated. Yeah. And so when I graduated, I got very disenfranchised working for somebody else. I worked at the VA, which was great, a great experience. I have very little negative things to say about that. But I didn't want to do that kind of work. I don't like our healthcare system in that we have, the way I describe it is, you got a problem, and that problem is a bonfire. Okay. Our healthcare system squirts water on the bonfire and it settles it down, but you still got these coals. And if you don't keep putting water on there and keeping that fire settled down, it's going to flare up again, right? That hose being medicines and the modern medicines and things of that nature. And I was always like, why are we trying to put water on the fire? Why don't we remove the logs that are causing the fire, right? Because there's a disease process that's making this fire burn. And I got very disenfranchised with that thought mentality. Like, hey, I have a problem. Here's a pill. That'll fix it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it never really fixes it. Like, why does somebody have diabetes? Yeah, I can get you pills to where bring your blood sugar down. Why do you have diabetes? Well, it's blood sugar control. Why is it blood sugar control? Well, maybe it's something you eat. Maybe you have a gene mutation. You know, maybe.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I'm going to reinvent healthcare. That was pretty grandiose. And after graduation, I started my own practice. And I started off as a wellness center in 2017. And I with zero patients, built this thing, a brick and mortar. I rented a space from a family member that had a dental office and converted a couple rooms into a clinic. And then started seeing patients on wellness. Ended up becoming a babysitter for people. I didn't like that. I didn't like telling them something and they never did it. And I wasn't very good at it. And I ended up turning my wellness practice into an aesthetic practice because people felt good when they left me. So I started doing Botox and filler and skin therapies and things like that, and really started focusing on aesthetics a couple years into that practice. Meanwhile, I have my day job at the hospital, right? I just started a business. I don't have an income from it yet. Mm-hmm. So I kept my day job at the hospital. It was actually a relief because I went from doing 16-hour days to 5 8-hour days, and I had every other weekend off. And I was like, oh, this is great. I got every other weekend off because I just finished a doctoral program.
Yeah.
Still working my butt off, you know, trying to build the business up. And then in 2019, they eliminated my position at the hospital and they said, hey, we'd love you to reapply for a similar position. And I was like, no, I'm going to just focus on my practice. And that's when my practice got really good. And when I focused 100% on it, and then I just started building my practice up, and other businesses have popped up along the way. You know, I now have a practice, I co-own a practice that we focus on upper airway issues. It's called Breathe Airway. Go check it out. We're changing. That's a very functional approach to medicine, which is up my wheelhouse. We're helping people with sleep disorder breathing, tongue ties, things of that nature. So we started that a couple of years ago and it's doing well. I have my practice, which we call Mountain West Medical Services, which is great. We do mostly aesthetics work. I do a lot of hair transplants in my clinic, which I find really fun because men hate going to the doctor and they hate doing vain things.
Yeah.
But if you don't have hair and I can give it back to you, I'm your hero. And so that's really fun in my practice. I do a lot of that. But yeah, my practice has been growing. It's been great. I now help nurses get into the industry, do a lot of education with that. I love educating. I did a brief stint with Idaho State University, where for a year or two, I was an adjunct faculty and I helped teach some courses. I found a lot of joy in that, educating nurses. And so, yeah, that's a very long-winded way of saying how I got here. 13 years of education. I wish I can go back to my 19-year-old self or 18-year-old self and say, hey, screw the biology degree, get a nursing degree, and let's cut, 8 years of education out of this.
Right. Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, it's that journey. Like,
it's the journey.
You learn so much along the way. And like you said, I mean, just hearing that story about all the education that you went through, and then now being sort of a teacher to others, and being able to apply all that learned, knowledge, teaching styles, all that kind of stuff that you saw from all the years in school. I mean, that's invaluable.
Yeah. And what's really valuable is, like, say, don't do this. I did that. That's dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, this is what you should do.
Yeah.
Right. Like, hey, let me mentor you the right way. And I have the approach that spread the wealth kind of mentality, like lift other people up and you'll lift yourself up in the process. That's kind of my motto, one of my mottos in life.
Mm-hmm.
My other motto is a lot of suck now for less suck later.
Yeah. I was going to mention that one. Yeah. I'd heard you say that in the past when talking to another nurse. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And I was about to say I can imagine, but I honestly can't. I couldn't imagine dealing with going to school for your doctorate and then also working full time.
Oh, it's awful.
Like, yeah. So I'm sure that
the only reason it worked is I had a very supportive wife.
Yeah.
And she literally ran our lives. Mm-hmm. Like, she took care of all the little things in my life. I didn't have to think about anything. The kids were well taken care of. She made sure they were getting a good education, feeding them, keeping them healthy, doing the doctor's appointments, because I literally had no time.
Yeah.
It was exhausting. Any kind of medical education is a big ordeal. Most of them are apprenticeship programs, like a physician goes through internship, residency, fellowships. Those are all apprenticeship programs, similar like what a electrician or a plumber would do. Same thing with nursing, there's a lot of apprenticeship in it. Like, if you're getting your nursing degree, you're hundreds of hours in the hospital, getting clinics done, following other nurses, then teaching you what you want to do. And then nurse practitioners, no different. Lots of mentors along the way. I've had some great mentors, like wonderful education experiences along the way. And part of my gig is I got to give it back.
Yeah.
Somebody helped me along the way. I got to help them along the way as well. So
it's very interesting how, like, when people look back on their lives, just how weird it always seems. Like, anyone you talk to, it's always such a weird story about, like, oh, I was doing this, and then, it's just like all these things that are cascading to lead them to where they are now. But looking back, you would have, if you had told your younger self, you would have been, I would never have done that.
Of course.
But then when you're sitting here, like, you would be a completely different person if you had done all the right things in the right order and everything.
We call those opportunities.
Yeah.
And not only, I want to be a little bit more specific, opportunities to suffer, because when you suffer, you're always better off on the other side. Unless it's like some sort of traumatic thing, like, some guy chopping your arm off.
Okay? Right.
We don't want that kind of suffering, but just the general suffering of life makes you a better person, and it makes you appreciate the good times.
Mm-hmm.
I teach my children, like the other day I took my kids hiking, and we spent, it was this horrible thing, like the other day, it's actually last summer. We went on a hike, and it was in early July, still snow up in the mountains. We were at like 8,000 feet here in the mountains of Idaho. And we're 4 miles in, and my son slipped on the ice and broke his arm.
Oh, wow.
In the backcountry, right? So we got kind of an emergency here, right? I've got a 12-year-old son with a broken arm. Luckily, his dad knew what to do. So I set the bone, I splinted. But we have all this gear. My other son, we piled stuff on our backs. I mean, it was just this horrible day. So we started off at like 7 a.m. hiking in. Then we got to turn. I mean, we were a quarter of a mile from where we were going to camp. Had to turn around, go back. The emergency room was this whole day. I mean, suffer, right? But what came from that? Hey, we accomplished something. We went over. I mean, it was this awful experience, but you look back and it's almost like you laugh about it a little bit.
Yeah.
And I told my kids, like, when we had hiked before he broke his arm, when we had hiked to this summit and we had this beautiful view of these high mountain lakes, I said, and they were all like, oh, wow, this is so pretty. And I go, yeah, the hard work makes you appreciate this, right? And they're like, yeah. And I go, well, let's imagine that another dad took a helicopter and dropped his kids off right here. Do you think they'd appreciate it as much as you would? And they're like, no. Why? Well, they didn't have to work hard to get here. No.
Yeah.
When you work hard to get somewhere, you sure appreciate the destination a lot more.
Yeah.
So hard work always gets you. You'll learn something from it, even if you fail. And you really don't fail. The only time you fail is when you give up on something, right? Like, mm-hmm. I told you I wanted to quit NP school. That would have been a failure.
Yeah.
But I stuck with it. I grinded it out. You grind it out. You might not take, you think you want to go from point A to point B, but life takes you to point C. Maybe that was the way it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so prophetic.
Yeah. But I mean, I find that it is interesting because, I mean, my wife is a nurse. Mm-hmm. So I've heard nurse stuff in the past, right, from her point of view. But it's interesting working for you and hearing these nurses' stories about how, you know, bedside nursing is super rewarding in some ways, mm-hmm. and horrible in other ways. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at my wife, for example, having her come home, it's a hit or miss how her day went. it could have been like one of the best days, you know, mm-hmm. like patients are like, you know, made a huge impact in someone's life, or, you know, their family members would come in and say something that was just so touching. Or you'd have those patients that were just horrible and you have to deal with them.
You have to.
And you have no other options but to deal with them. And you have to find a way to deal with them in, you know, the best, you know, make it the best situation you can. But I do find it interesting that a lot of times nurses or, you know, other fields that are out there, someone will complain about a job or a situation that they're in, but they're not really willing to, you know, endure the suck of now, mm-hmm. of building something else up, of starting your own business, mm-hmm. of trying to go into a different career or a different path. So like you said, you could have sat and continued to deliver pizzas. And like you said, you felt pretty good right about then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being able to drive around, listen to the radio, not have like the stress, mm-hmm. of some jobs, but you didn't see like that growth potential.
Yep.
And I think that's very big for some people. Some people are like, okay, just sitting in, you know, whatever situation they're in right then. And they're not really willing to put in the work or the effort to kind of grow and, you know, see what's over that horizon.
Yeah. One of my mottos is ABG, always be grinding, which leads to always be growing.
True.
Right. So that kind of speaks to what you're saying, but yeah, bedside nurse is awful. In fact, I remember a day, and I share this story often with people. I was 3 months in to bedside nursing, and I was having a horrible night. I mean, I had a woman that was literally having diarrhea every 15 minutes and constantly going in there and cleaning her up and bedpans. She couldn't get out of bed. I mean, she's so sick. Had that going on. Had a crazy person I'm dealing with. I worked night shift at the time, and they always went crazy at about 7 p.m., as our nurse listeners know. Had that happening, had too many patients, we were understaffed, I had literally no nursing assistants, and all the other nurses were in the same situation. I just needed some help, and I couldn't get some help, and I was just dying. And I was at the nursing pod, and I'm literally looking at my notes, and I'm thinking, how am I going to tell my wife in the morning that I'm quitting? Okay. And I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at my notes going, I'm quit. I cannot do this forever.
Yeah.
Like, this was a mistake. I mean, and now we're making a little bit of money. You know, my wife's been supporting me through school, and I'm making a little bit of money. And I'm like, I'm going to tell her I'm going to quit. And I cannot tell you, I mean, there is a God, because as I'm sitting there, this really positive nurse came up, and she's sitting right next to me having these thoughts. And her name was Megan. And I've seen her many times since, and every time I see her, I always mention this story to her, and so she knows it well. But she literally turns to me and says, aren't you so happy that we have such a great job? There's so many people out there that would wish they could have a job like us. And
yeah.
Trying to get in nursing. And this was in 2008, 2009, somewhere in there. No, sorry, 2011 is when I started nursing. And the economy was awful. Like, it was hard for me to get a nursing job. Like, I took the first nursing job I could get. the economy was horrid. Like, people were unemployed. I mean, you remember what 2011 was like. Gas prices were like $4.50 a gallon, and this is 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, we were, the economy was struggling. And she's like, aren't you just so grateful that we have a job where we can help people and we can make a good living and that we're employed? And, you know, and she just, she went on this little 30-second rant on how grateful she was. And I was like, you son of a bitch. Like,
yeah,
you need to check yourself. Yeah. Like, this is a mental game. Like, and I would show up to work thinking, what a horrible night I'm going to have. And then I started showing up to work thinking, I'm going to have a great night. Mm-hmm. And when you make that switch, the crap you deal with, hey, just put it to the side.
Yeah.
And you focus on the good stuff. And she helped me make that switch. And I tell every time I see her, I'm like, yeah, you kept me in it. You kept me in it. And the best part of that story is I was at my airway clinic that we started a couple years ago. And she showed up with her baby. And her her baby had some issues we were helping with. And I was like, oh my gosh, I built this for her. She kept me in this. And now she's using the services that I am helping. I am providing.
Yeah.
For her.
That's a crazy turnaround.
Oh, it was surreal.
Yeah.
And she had a husband at that point. I don't think she had a husband when, and I told him that story because I had told her that story. Oh, and by the way, she became a nurse practitioner before I did. And, was kind of a mentor in that process as well. So it's just funny how God, you know, puts you in a space to be your most. So mm-hmm. just if life sucks, just grind through it.
Yeah.
You're going to be better on the other side.
Yeah.
100% you'll be on the better side. But yeah, I remember that very vividly. Night shifts were terrible. And it wrecks your body health. Like, your circadian rhythms when you're working night shift, not good for your health. I still have problems today with sleep.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah. When I worked at the hospital, I worked swing shift.
That's not terrible.
It's not terrible. But it was interesting to see because you were there when the day shift nurses were there. And then you were there when the night shift nurses were there. And the things that they deal with are completely different.
They are.
Because like the day shift nurses, they are, everything's very chaotic, but there's always lots of people around to help you. There's different people on, like, whether it's like, you know, respiratory or, you know, a doctor that's around, they can all help you. Whereas I feel like the night shift nurses, they definitely have less like chaos going on.
Yeah.
But it's when it gets bad, it gets really bad because you have a lot less resources 100%. To deal with and you have less people to rely on. So you kind of have to be, it's like, it seems very different to me.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I did. And it was night and day difference, right? I did night shift for 5 years and then I went to day shift and finished off 3 years at day shift when I got in that or part of my managerial responsibilities. Totally different. Yeah, it was a totally different culture, totally different health.
Mm-hmm.
Having to switch back and forth between a day life and a night life is so unhealthy. In fact, the World Health Organization classifies shift work as a carcinogen. Like, and if you do the studies, night shift workers live 9 years less than day shift workers.
That's a lot of time.
I literally took years of my life off doing that freaking night shift. Why? Oh, because they paid me 19% more. Not worth it.
Yeah, or like the mom or dad nurses out there that do it because they can spend more time with their kids or they're able to get them to and from.
The female nurses, I mean, you know, society puts a lot of pressure on moms to be moms. They would work all night, stay up all day with their kids and work the next night. And frequently because dad's out doing his day job. Can't tell you how many nurses do that. And they come in, they just look like death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they only got 2 or 3 hours of sleep. And I'm like, hey, man, you just got 2 or 3 hours of sleep. And now you got to go take care of patients that could die.
Yeah.
Like, is this the smartest thing? That's our healthcare system.
And that's the interesting thing that I've always heard is that it's like you give so much as a nurse. Mm-hmm. And so then when you're at work all day, you're giving all that energy, all that care and support to your patients. And then you have to come home and deal with your children or your husband or your wife. Sometimes you just don't have any more to give. Yeah.
You come home, you eat dinner, you go to bed. I mean, that's literally it. You get done it. You know, your shifts are 12-hour shifts, which are awful. Everybody's like, oh, I love 12-hour shifts. I only have to be working 3 days. Yeah, okay, but you're dead to the world for those 3 days. When I started doing clinic hours and I got home at 4 or 5 in the afternoon and I had dinner with my family, I could go to a ball game and watch my kids and I could do all that. Who cares? I'll work 5 days a week doing that. I have every evening to be a normal person and I could go to church events. I could do whatever I wanted. Yeah, I'll do that Monday through Friday versus Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Friday, Thursday, all day, every day, holidays, Christmas. Blech.
Well, and then those days that you don't work, you're using them as like a catch up almost.
100%.
You're like, oh, I'm going to sleep a little extra because I got so little sleep the last 3 days. Oh, I'm going to
lose a day a week.
You know, household chores now. And so it's just like, yeah, a lot of catch up. And
yeah, you totally lose a day a week. I mean, I kind of figured out my secret sauce. I would do 3 on, 1 off, 3 on. And then that 1 off, I would not switch. I would just stay up and watch like Netflix or something. That's what I did. And then I have a week of normalcy. But even that week of normalcy, you got to play catch up.
Yeah.
You're exhausted. And so you lose a day of that week. Anyways, I'm getting a little PTSD.
Yeah. It's interesting to just think about how many people, like you talked about hospitals as a business. There's so many staff at these large hospitals. And it's so interesting to think of how all these, so many of these staff members are on the weirdest schedules. You know, we would be going down to the pharmacy and we talk to the pharmacist down there and you hear that he works like 2 weeks straight and then has like a month off. Mm-hmm. And it's just like these things that they'll put themselves through to try and like have some semblance of like work-life balance. But then it's like at a cost of what?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. Anesthesiologists are notorious for that. They'll do 24-hour shifts. They'll sleep at the hospital. They'll get called in for emergencies, you know, because they always have to have at least one anesthesiologist at the hospital. Mm-hmm. They're notorious for that. And then you've got your residents and all that who literally live at the hospital. They never go home, working 120 hours a week for 5 years, 4 years residency. I mean, it is a calling.
Yeah,
it is a calling. And you're rewarded for it financially, I think. Nurses, not so much. Well, I mean, now it's getting better.
Yeah, I think to me, the interesting thing to me for nurses is if you look at a lot of jobs, I actually feel like I would never want to work at a fast food restaurant because I feel like they work really hard. Mm-hmm. Like they're constantly busy, you know, they have like all this stuff to get through. So it's like in terms of your skills you have to bring to the table.
Not much.
Not much, but it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of jobs, as you start to move up or you have the education or the experience behind you, your tasks become a little bit easier and easier.
I call it thinking jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
You get paid to think.
Yeah.
That's what society values is the thinkers, which is exhausting.
Yeah. But then the thing is at least in my opinion, I'm not a nurse, but looking in on it, it seems like nurses, like they get paid well, but for what they have to deal with.
Sure.
It's questionable sometimes because, like you said, a thinking job, nurses, it's physical and thinking.
It is very
you're on your feet all day long, and then you're also having to sit there and, you know, high-stress environments, thinking about all these different things that you're dealing with, you know, time management with, like, all the different patients you have. It just seems like a lot.
Yeah. I just thought of a funny story. You want to hear a funny story?
Let's hear it.
I may have shared this before. I don't know. Did I talk about have I ever talked about the story where the man got stuck in his car for like 4 days?
Yeah.
I did talk about that. Darn it.
Yeah.
The funny, well, for those of you listening, I'll go ahead and rehash it a little bit, but I'll tell you the funny part. Anyways, this guy, 400 or 500 pounds, got stuck in a car and had to live in there for like 4 days. It broke down in the middle of the desert, couldn't get out. Feces everywhere, urine everywhere, literally lived off mountain doing Doritos for 3 days until the firefighters found him. It's a horrible story. Like, poor guy.
Yeah.
The funny part about that story is here I have this, I think he was 550 pounds because we had to get special beds for him. That's coming to mind. The funny part of that story is I was the charge nurse and I had to sign him to a nurse. And the only nurse I had was this 90 pound Filipino.
Oh gosh.
Shirt nurse. And I'm like, okay, this is your patient. You can't, she have no muscles. It's going to take a team. But it was just this contrast between, and she was the hardest working nurse we've ever had. This little tiny nurse and this gigantic patient.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of funny, that contrast. But yeah, back to the physicality of nursing. You would literally break your back. I mean, I can't tell you how many workman's comp claims we had. I had a workman's comp claim. You know, you twist your back, a patient falls, you try to catch them, you hurt yourself. You know, I had physical therapy from that. You know, I can't tell you how many nurses hurt backs. We had one, this is a horrible story. They had just implemented this thing called code gray precautions. Code gray, gray means silver, or silver, code gray, I can't remember. But basically, code gray meant the patient was crazy. Mm-hmm. And we got a situation at risk of hurting themselves or others. Literally, they implemented this new protocol. And all of a sudden, somebody calls code gray. And I run into the room, and this man had gone crazy. He thought there was ants on his face. And this nurse was trying, the nursing assistant was trying to help him. And decked her, broke her thumb, beat her up.
Yeah.
And then myself and another male nurse had to like throw him against the wall and restrain him. And security got called and tied to the bed. And I just remember going in there, and this young lady was just hovering in the corner like, please don't kill me. They sent her home. She never came back. I never saw her again.
Wow.
Yeah, she had to leave. I mean, think about the psychological stress. You cannot do your job again.
Yeah.
I mean, literally broke your thumb or finger or something. And I mean, he was just nuts, you know, I don't remember why. And it was a bad situation. That happens all the time.
Yeah. I know.
I've had plates thrown at me. I literally walked through the door, and I see a plate flying through the air because they were just waiting for somebody to come in. I did a little matrix thing where I was like, over me. I've had, you know, people take swings at me, kick me, you know. And what's really funny is Idaho 4 or 5 years ago implemented it's longer than that. It's been probably about 10 years ago. They implemented if you hurt a healthcare professional, automatic felony.
Okay.
Okay. We're like, great, this is great. Guess how many times it's been enacted? Zero. Like, they're all crazy.
Yeah,
it's hard to kind of... The prosecutors don't prosecute it.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, we have the law on the books. Yeah, it's a felony to do stuff like this. Never. It may have been used once or twice, but to my knowledge, it's never been really... They don't really use that law. The emergency rooms are really bad. These people come off the street and crazy, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think
so. I don't miss those days.
I think a lot of newer nurses also don't realize how serious they are about that. Like, my mom worked in education at the hospital, and she would have you know, these classes where they would talk about, like, you know, be careful of your lanyard, like leaning, because mm-hmm. people will grab it and pull you in, and like all these different things that you never would think about. But then they go to talk to you about these things, and you kind of, as a new nurse, you're like, oh, you know, how often does that happen?
It
and
does.
It's like these same, you know, nurses that have worked there for a long time are sitting through those classes and being like, yeah, I've heard this, but I've also seen it all the time. So
yeah,
I couldn't imagine having to deal with like a patient where it's like, you're having to care for them, but then at the same time, you have to be so careful about, like, you know, treading lightly around them, and like, what's going to set them off? What's like, what can I do? And then just like you said about like the shift change around, like, you know, 7 o'clock, and these patients are starting to just lose it. And you're
like,
they were perfect for me all day. And now I'm handing them off to you. And so it's like, for me, married to a nurse, it's like one of those things that it's so funny, actually. Just last night.
Here we go.
Yeah, just last night.
We got to get your wife in here.
I know we do, but just last night she was, like, I normally hear from her around the same time, and she always calls me when she's on her way out of the hospital. And so I hadn't heard from her, and so I gave her a call, and I can tell, like, she answers, but she's like, I can't talk right now. And so I'm like, okay, so she's clearly still at work. And then she finally calls me, like, an hour later, and so she's been there an extra, like, hour and a half, right? And she calls me and she's like, sorry, we just had a patient that was trying to die on us.
Yep.
You know? So it's just like those things.
By the way, they die mostly at the evening hours. I just kicked.
Yeah.
Make sure I didn't hit our sound or something. Yeah, they all die. The most common time to die is like first thing in the morning, at dawn, for whatever reason. And then the next most common time is at dusk. The light shift, the circadian rhythm shift really messes people up. Yeah, deaths are horrible. Horrible, sometimes very rewarding. I've told about some deaths experience I've had. I'll tell you another crazy experience I had was we had this lady come in, very Christian, very straight edge. You could tell she's very devout. And her husband checked in. I can't remember what she was there for, infection or something. And you do a health intake on everybody. Hey, what meds are you on? Are you on any illegal substances? You know, are you? Well, she was. She was addicted, I think, to narcotics or something, some pain pills. She didn't want her husband to know about it. So she said, no. We didn't know any better. Just keep going and checking in. Her husband leaves, and then she withdraws. Well, she can't own up to it. And she goes crazy, and now she's not herself.
Yeah.
Like, literally a demonic person. And you would not have known that she was a kind, sweet, wonderful person. But the neurotransmitter switched, and she went nuts. We had a hard restrainer. Different levels of restraint, soft restraints, hard restraints, soft restraints. There's protocols, hard restraints. You literally like lock them down with belt buckles and stuff. Had a heart restrainer. We had a chemically restrainer. We had to call doctors in. She ripped shelves off the wall and threw them at people.
Wow.
And she was in isolation, meaning that sometimes you get bacteria resistant, or excuse me, antibiotic resistant bacteria. And when you don't want that to spread throughout the hospital, and so you'll gown up and glove up and put masks on and things of that nature so you don't spread it to another room. So here she is going crazy, and she has this contagious condition that we have to be in isolation for. So you have to deal with her. You have to gown up, and she's swinging at you, and you're pinning her down, and she's literally spitting at you, and just her infections going everywhere in the room, all over the staff. There's no way you can get around it. And I remember running in there, because they were desperate and I didn't have time to gown up. And they're like, you go gown up because we don't want you to get sick. So I went back out, gowned up, and went in and pinned her down. And then we finally got to the bottom of it. Like, they did a tox screen on her, and they're like, oh my gosh, she's swimming in opiates. And then you get her on the detox medication and stuff like that. If I remember right, it was an opiate withdrawal. But yeah, that kind of stuff, no bueno.
Yeah. That's wild too, to think like you're in a situation like that. You're like, please calm down for a moment. Well,
yeah, there's no reasoning.
Just let me calm down so I can put on all this like PPE before I go in there and then deal with you.
Yeah. So yeah, I've had feces thrown at me. I've had, we had this one, we did a lot of pancreatic surgeries, and there's something called the common bile duct. And a lot of times that bile duct will get injured and disease or surgery or something like that, and they have to do a bypass. Well, you have to have your pancreatic enzymes. So if the pancreas can't drain into your intestines, you can't digest certain foods. So your pancreas is cranking out these enzymes, but there's no bile duct to common bile duct to let it go through. So it build up and you'd have problems. So they put something called a T-tube in, and where you can drain it externally. So you'll put a tube in into the pancreas and you can drain it. So the crazy part was the doctors would make us drain this fluid, which is green and the nastiest smelling vomitish mess you can imagine, right? And then we'd have to reinfuse it into their stomach. So because that duct was damaged and they needed it, we'd put a tube in and we'd reinfuse it. So we're hanging vomit on a bag. Gravity's taking it in. So I mean, I have this patient, and he was in there for months. And those are the worst patients, because you get to know them, and you get people's worst comes out in the hospital. And if you're in there for months and your worst is what you get to know, it's like, I don't want to deal with this patient.
Yeah.
Anyways, he would go crazy. I go in one time. He literally has that bag of juices, and he's drinking it.
Oh, God. Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you doing? I won't say his name for privacy person, but I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm supposed to get this, and go, 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 go. I'm like, oh my gosh. And you know, he's spilling all over him. I gotta clean him up. I'm like, well, I guess I don't have to reinfuse that.
Yeah.
you know, just nasty stuff. So I was on the gastrointestinal unit, and we did a lot of like nasal gastric tubes and refeeding and tube feeds and crazy stuff. Other crazy stuff that I had to deal with, there's this thing called a fistula. A fistula is an artificial passageway between two body systems. So, for instance, you can have a fistula between an artery and a vein, okay? Or you can have a fistula between one part of the intestine and another part of intestine, okay? The craziest fistulas were intestine that would create a artificial opening to the outside world. So you would get, we call them mucus fistulas. So they would literally spontaneously erupt. Think of it like a blister. The intestinal wall would corrode, get to the abdominal wall, and the digestive enzymes would eat through the abdominal walls and then come out to the outside. And you'd have to put a bag on there, and literally feces are coming out into this bag from this wound.
Mm-hmm.
I literally watched one of those form once. This patient's like, oh, my stomach. Oh, and I'm watching, and I see this like thing bubbling up, and then I'm like, we got a fistula. And then it's just poop coming out. A lot of times after abdominal surgery where they cut you open, a fistula would form because they would nick it or something, or the wall was weak and they moved weird and fistula would form. And we'd put diapers on people and feces is just coming out of their stomach. You know, not like an ostomy bag, which is a surgical procedure. Mm-hmm. We want that to happen. This is like, and there's no surgical remedy for it. You just have to let it heal.
Interesting.
And so for months, they would just have this fistula and then you just hope it heals. And eventually they did, but it was just nasty, 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 nasty stuff. Nasty stuff. The gastrointestinal stuff was nasty.
Yeah, that's why, like, for me, having worked at the hospital, I can't imagine, like, being in those situations for long term. Because there was a floor I knew about, you know, I'd have to go up there, and it always just had that smell.
Mm.
And I'm just like, I can't, I mean, granted, they probably
get, the floor I worked on.
Yeah, they probably get kind of used to it, but it's like one of those things that, man, and that's from the hallways and around the nurse's station. That's not going in.
Body stink.
Yeah.
Body stink. Let's have we should start doing the stinkiest thing you've ever smelled segment.
Right.
The one smell I could not tolerate was a bacterial or an antibiotic resistant infection, which was called C. difficile.
Mm-hmm.
C. diff. Clostridium difficile, and it's just the worst diarrhea ever. And oftentimes it would eat away and make you bleed internally. And when you have a GI bleed mixed with C. diff, go for the hills. Call quit.
Yeah.
Don't go into work that day. Call out sick. Because it. I would literally put a mask on. I'd put like some sort of like lavender oil, because we carry lavender oil for therapeutic. I put lavender oil on the side of the mask, and I know I have to go in this patient's room, and there's just stool everywhere. I put that on so I could just smell the lavender and just hold my breath, go in there, get it done real quick. And you have to gown up, right?
This is
antibiotic resistant. And then, you know, you move the right way, and then it's, and you get that whiff, and you're like, and you're like gagging.
Yeah.
You can't gag in front of the patient because they would feel bad. But yeah, it just smells.
It's funny that you say that, because it's like, I would get calls from nurses, you know, saying, we need a precautions card up here.
Mm.
My patient has C. diff. And this sadness in their voice,
I know.
Just like, I have to deal, you know, please bring one up.
Well, when you have somebody in precautions, it adds 30 extra minutes of work a night for that one patient. Because every time they call, you got to gown up.
Yeah.
You got to go in there. And then when you leave, you have to do this certain cleaning. You know, like C. diff, you have to wash your hands with soap and water. You can't just put alcohol swabs. So there's extra time. And then I can't tell you how many times you leave and all the nurses that are listening to me go, yep, I know where he's going with this. You'd be like, okay, is there anything else you need to do? You need to go to the bathroom? You need food? You need water? No. Okay. And then as soon as you ungown and you get out, the light goes on. Oh, I forgot. I do need this. And you're like, now I have to gown back up, go in there, and take you to the bathroom when I just asked you if you needed to go.
Yeah.
And you're like, sucked. You thought I was out and you sucked me back in.
Yeah.
Right.
But, well, I think... a lot of times with the nurse stories, it's always like something very sad or a crazy story. But do you have any stories that you could think of that are more of like a time where you really changed someone's life, or you were able to really, you knew like going home, you're like, wow, I really made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First thing that popped in mind, I had I was relatively new, probably around that 3-4 months. And so there's a steep learning curve, right? You just, you know how to get, you learn how to get through your day, but you do not learn how to look for bad things, right? I mean, you have the basics to be safe, but I had this patient, she was a post-operative patient and had a bariatric surgery, a gastric bypass, and she said, something's wrong. I'm like, okay. And I'm looking at her vital signs. Everything looks fine. I'm like, okay, well, I'll keep an eye on you. And she's like, I just said something wrong. So I started watching her, and her blood pressure was trending down, heart rate's trending up, which could be an infection. It could be a bleed or something like that. Well, she had a drain, and then all of a sudden the drain started sucking out frank red blood. Usually it's just sucking out like swelling, as we call it, serosaguinous fluid. And I'm like, she's bleeding. And so I drained it. I turned the drain back on. It filled up instantly. And I'm like, ooh, we got a problem. And I was new. And when you're new, all you want to do is get through the night and make it somebody else's problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I knew it was like 10 o'clock. And I'm like, or midnight. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to, she'll be dead if it is a bleed. So I called the doctor and I said, hey, this is what's going on. He goes, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Shows up. He looks. He's like, yeah, let's get her in surgery. Got her in surgery. And he evacuated something like 3 pints of blood out of her guts.
Wow.
They had to do blood transfusion. She ended up in the ICU. So, I mean, it's literally saved her life. Like, that's cool.
Yeah.
Right? Like, when you save somebody's life, that's pretty cool. So I did that. I have a funny saved life story. This is a funny one. We had a patient, very large woman, and she had very pendulous breasts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which you will understand why I mentioned that here in a little bit.
Okay.
She was on a big bed. And so we had different beds, and people that are listening to you that aren't in the healthcare industry, this is very interesting. So you have your standard bed, which the hospital owns. Then there's companies out there that keep in the hospital, their own specialty beds. And the hospital literally stored these beds and would rent them from the companies when they needed them.
Oh.
And it was cheaper to do that than to buy and maintain the beds. So these companies were responsible, and it was just the weirdest thing because they're in the hospital, they're ready to be used by the hospital, but they're not the hospital's property. The hospital would rent these beds, okay? And so we had a large bed or a large person with this pendulous breast, and she was on one of these specialty beds. Well, the specialty beds were kind of infrequently used, and so you didn't really know how to use them very well.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, she coded. Her heart stopped beating. Her oxygen fell off. The monitor didn't pick up on it. She had like pulled her monitor off her finger, so it wasn't beeping or something. And the nurse, we had a new nurse that was taking care of her, went into the room, and she's purple, not breathing. So they call it code blue, and everybody runs in. Well, they couldn't figure out how to lower this bed. And the other thing with these beds is they all have air in them. So during a code, you flip a switch or pull a tube out, and the bed deflates, and then you can throw something hard underneath them so you could do chest compressions. Well, they couldn't figure out how to do that. So I was the tallest one, so I jumped up on the bed and I start doing compressions on this woman. Okay, but she's on a mattress and there's some give.
Yeah.
Okay, so I start getting into a rhythm. You know, and the gown's ripped open. She's naked there, and you're on top, and you're doing compressions. Well, the compression and the rhythm and the bounce,
yes.
The breasts would start coming up and slapping.
Yeah,
like in between. Like I'm here, and they'd come up over my hands and slap, and I had to dodge them every time I do a compression.
Yeah.
And so I'm like compressing her, and the breasts are like trying to hit me in the face, and I'm like going like this, and it's comical now. It was like.
You're like, hold these down. Weird. Yeah, you're like, get these out of the way.
And I'm like, get the mattress turned off. I'm like, we don't know how. It's a rental bed, you know, and I'm doing this. And, you know, you only have to, you switch out every 2 minutes or so. So for 2 minutes, I had to do that. And then finally, I get off, and I just ripped the hose because every bed has a little compressor.
Mm-hmm.
I just ripped the hose out of the bed. It's not our bed.
Yeah.
And it goes, deflates. So we put something underneath there. And then the crisis team came on and started doing compressions. And I was like, oh, my gosh. She lived. Yeah, we saved her life.
Awesome.
She woke up in a lot of pain. Oh, I think we broke a rib.
Yeah.
And got her some fentanyl and sent her down to ICU. And but yeah, she lived. But it was a I didn't do many compressions on my floor. That was one that I remember. And it was kind of fun to think back on it.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, so those are two life-saving stories. You know, we have a up the rear segment. I'll give you an up the rear story.
Okay, let's hear it.
I might be able to get you a photo of this.
Really?
I might be able to. So for those listening, we might cut to a photo here in a little bit because there's not any patient identifiers on it. Had a patient come in. I was relatively new and had a dildo stuck up his rear end. Okay. And which happened frequently, unfortunately. But this sex toy was exceptionally large, and it was the shape of a human fist and an arm, forearm. And it literally was the size of my fist, or maybe a woman's size of a fist and a forearm.
Yeah.
So cut my arm off there. The entire thing was stuck. And when you put something that big up, it actually tears through all the tissue, tears through the bowels, tears through all that stuff. And it literally went from the anus all the way to the diaphragm. Okay. Well, so it came in and the radiologist had fun with this image and they took all the soft tissue and everything away and left the arm and the skeleton.
Yeah.
So you can see what had happened.
Yeah.
And my buddy, who I will not name, we all looked at him like, oh my gosh, that image is just something. And the patient left. Well, we knew the patient would be back in a year because they have to give them a ostomy bag because their bowels have to heal and we knew the patient would be back in a year. Anyways, long story short, my buddy was waiting for the day because he couldn't remember the patient's name. Well, he remembered the patient's name, but he didn't want to get into their file when they weren't a patient because that's a violation, right? You can't look at patients' files unless you're taking care of the patient. So the day came back and this patient came in and he took a little screenshot of just the image. There's no identifiers on the patient.
Yeah, just like
that. So it should be fine. But and then that image got circulated around. And but he was like so happy when the patient came back because he could get this photo because it'll blow your mind. Like I hope I can find it and show it to you because it'll blow your mind. And you know it's not fabricated because the end of the sex toy, there's a string that's dangling, and you can see that in the image.
Yeah.
But how he got it up there.
It's wild what people do too. Like these kind of things. It's like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
And they're probably thinking that same thing when they're driving in. Like, I can't believe I'm so stupid and I did this.
Oh, sure.
And now I have to go deal with it.
Yeah. Other ones I've had, I had a PVC pipe that was 9 centimeters in diameter with a sock that was duct taped to the top that he fell on.
Yeah, it's always the I fell on.
Yeah, that's Seinfeld thing, right? Yeah. Remember that episode? Like, talk, it was a million to one shot, right? And I fell on this. Toothpaste rolls, plastic water bottles would get stuck up there. People don't realize when you put something in your rear end, there's a vacuum and you can't pull it out.
Yeah.
So there's like sex toys are designed to be safe. It's like they'll let air in so you don't get a vacuum when you're trying to pull it out.
Yeah.
But
they have to go through the
abdomen, have surgery,
right?
Yeah. They all have surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to cut the abdomen up, cut the bowel open and get it out. It usually buys you an ostomy bag for a year. The toothpaste roll, what happened? They put the toothpaste roll up and then it rolled over because it's a toothpaste. And when you try to pull it, snagged.
Yeah.
Water bottles, candles, lots of sex toys. Yeah, crazy stuff.
The only up the butt story that is anywhere close to that, that I could even think of that I've dealt with that's somewhat funny would be like, you'd always get calls from nurses who sometimes you didn't need to like straight cath a patient. So you'd be using like a temporary catheter. It was basically looked like a condom. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, when I first started working there, you know, we had multiple sizes of them. And so you'd like on the phone, you'd be like, okay, well, what size do you need? And they would just be like, you know, like, what kind of question is this? Be like, well, there's, you know, and you're going through like explaining, oh, there's different sizes. And you know that, you know, like they're on the phone and they're like, you know, should I go in there and take a look and see what kind of
how big the penis is?
Yeah, right? And so it's like I learned like pretty quickly. Just take
the medium one.
Oh, no, take all three up there. Take all the sizes up there. Let them decide. Come back later to pick up the ones they didn't use. But save the patient and also the nurse the awkwardness of having to kind of figure that out on
management
the phone.
Management hated that, by the way. Because I don't know if you know this. You probably did because you're in supply chain. Anytime something went to the unit got billed for it.
Yeah.
And if you did that, they got billed for three things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you picked them up, then you would credit the unit, right?
Yeah.
And they kept track of every supply, and nurses all had their supplies they liked, like specific types of heating pads or specific sizes types of absorbent pads that maybe this unit doesn't stock. So we'd go to other units and steal, and then managers hated it because the other nurses would go to their unit to find something.
Yeah.
You know, because supply chain couldn't find it for them. But I remember when I got into it, looking at the supply list, we were spending something like $20,000 a year on our unit in hot packs.
Yeah.
Okay. And a hot pack for IV starts, you'd put a hot pack down. They were like $125 a piece, and nurses were ordering those left and right. And then finally our manager told supply chain, you cannot deliver these to my unit. They can get a hot blanket out of the blanket warmer. And then we'd go to another unit and steal the hot packs.
Yeah.
They were so good. But hot packs were a hot one. Those kits, like a catheter kit, $100.
I know it's the
$150.
When you realize
bag of IV fluid, $200.
Yeah. Well, it's because insurance. You know, it's like,
I know.
And the prices that some of these companies can charge a hospital for, it's actually crazy to look at the prices of things. And then it's funny to see how often, you know, you have reps coming around and how you're instructed, you know, like, you know, they're going to try and do this, that, you know, but you're not allowed to do that. So it's just kind of this interesting look at like the politics and trying to like, you know, slide into the hospital as a company and get, because they're, you know, a large hospital that chooses to switch from, you know, one glove manufacturer.
Oh,
to
that was
another.
A big deal.
It's insane.
Speaking of gloves, this is crazy on supply stuff. When I started, we had these gray gloves, like nitrile gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And you get used to these gloves, and the nurses hated these gloves. And I was new, and I was like, I don't. And they're like, we're gonna get management to buy these aloe vera gloves, because every time you put your hands in, aloe vera would coat your hands and make your hands smooth, because you're constantly alcohol and dried out. And I mean, I'm looking at my hands right now. I wash my hands every day, you know, with alcohol, they're all dried and chappy. So they switched to these aloe vera, and it was an extra, I don't know, 50 cents a box. But management acquiesced. I mean, they're like borderline strike to get these gloves. And the gloves came in, I'm like, these are awful. Like, this is stupid. What a waste of money.
Yeah.
So years go by and I'm using these gloves and you just don't know any better. And then the gloves went away, or the supply chain, something happened, and they had to go back to these gray gloves. And I put the gray gloves on. I'm like, these are junk.
Yeah.
Like, I want my aloe vera gloves. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm one of them. Like, and to this day, I like my aloe vera gloves.
Yeah.
And I do pay a little premium in my clinic for aloe vera gloves.
Yeah, there are so many times nurses would do that. They'd call down and ask for a certain product, and you'd be like, no, we don't have those anymore. And they'd just be so upset because it was something they relied on so much. But the cost that goes into the hospital, it's just insane. And so like any amount that they can save or get some kind of contract with a company, it's like it really adds up. And I think that's the interesting thing that you pointed out at the beginning, was trying to get into more of like preventative medicine and like wellness.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy how much healthcare and being sick is such an industry in this country, especially in the US.
Yeah, let me put it in perspective. I might have shared this statistic before. I think I did. 1/3 of Medicaid dollars are spent on the last month of a person's life.
Yeah.
1/3. Okay. And the other thing that people don't realize, 53% of healthcare dollars are government dollars. Medicare, TRICARE, VA, and Medicaid.
Yeah.
Like over half of the dollars spent are already being spent by the government. So when you start talking about like socialized medicine and stuff like that, you're like, well, you might want to, I'm not going to get into socialized medicine, whether it's good or bad, but I'm like, well, we kind of have a socialized medicine program already. It's called Medicare.
Yeah.
Medicare runs the roost. Like Medicare sets this tone. Medicare sets pricing. Insurance follows whatever Medicare does.
Yeah.
To a point. But it's much more profitable to treat sick than it is to treat well, which is why if you're an MD and you're getting into a residency program, which one are you going to pick? Primary care, which pays you, let's call it $150,000, $250,000 a year, or dermatology, which pays you $1 million a year. And the organization I worked for was nonprofit, so they would list how much the doctors made. They had to by law. Urologists were making $1 million a year. Like, that was a very profitable branch of medicine. And on their reporting, there was never a primary care doctor. They never made enough to be reported. It was always the neurologists, the urologists. And they should make money, obviously, because they went through so much hell to get there.
Yeah.
But the wellness side does not pay well.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. And if you're going to spend 13 years in school, why get into something that doesn't pay well? This is an interesting study. When I was graduating my NP program, this primary care physician published a study that got picked up in one of the journals. And he figured out how many hours he spent in his residency and his education and non-productive time, how much money he spent on that non-productive time, how much money he could have made in another job. Okay. And those were his opportunity costs, right? Mm-hmm. It cost me this much money to get my doctorate. Then he got into primary care and he figured out how much money he made as a primary care. And he retired like 67 or 70 or something like that. So he had a pretty long career in primary care. And then he averaged it all out. How many hours I spent as a primary care doctor, how many hours I spent in my training, and how much cost it took me. And he averaged it all out. And guess how much money he made per hour over the course of his career?
I'm scared to hear.
$38 an hour. $38 an hour. He basically had nursing wages. So he went through all that headache for a career of 38 hours. He would have been better off being a plumber.
Yeah.
He would have made a lot more money or something else like that. So you don't do it for the money. You do it for the joy of helping people. But even the joy of helping people, you get burned out. Like if you look at burnout literature, it's all done with nursing. The average nurse stays in their first job for like 2.5 years. And then they vacate because of the burnout.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a baccalaureate prepared nurse. 2.5 years is all they stay. It costs a organization something like $60,000 to replace a experienced nurse. And you're only going to be there for 2.5 years. And then the organization has to pay $60,000 to replace you because all that knowledge and skill set went away.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw a lot of job hopping in the hospital. So if you get bored in your job, there's so many opportunities in nursing.
Yeah.
I mean, look at me. I mean, I went from that to managerial. Now I'm running my own clinic and all in the nursing world.
Yeah. Speaking of kind of nursing degrees and mm-hmm. all the things you can do with it, what would you say to someone who maybe is just finishing nursing school or thinking about going to nursing school? What would something like a good takeaway that you could give to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Think about like what you want in your life. Like what kind of work do you want to do? If you want to help people, that's fine. Bedside nursing is, I hate to say it's a rite of passage because you don't necessarily have to do it. It does give you these cool, fun stories because all the fun stories come from bedside nursing. I don't mind that avenue. I think if you want to become a nurse practitioner, get into emergency room because you're going to see it all. And you're going to learn the way to work a patient up on the job. So if you want to become a nurse practitioner, get into that. If you want to become a organizational leader, do a stint of bedside nursing and start climbing the corporate ladder. Okay. Lots of opportunity in leadership in nursing. I would go to leadership conference, quarterly leadership conference at my hospital. And 90% of them were nurses. Like healthcare is run by nurses. You know, the very top might be physicians, but right underneath there, all the department leads are nurses. Education's run by nursing. Research is run by nursing, et cetera. Like the vast majority. So if you want to get into education, you can do your stint as a floor nurse and then become a floor educator, and then you can climb the corporate ladder. So it really depends on where you want to be. What I would not recommend nurses do is become a PA. If you're a PA, PAs just don't have the scope of practice authority that nurse practitioners do. So if you want to be a provider, I would not go to medical school unless you want to be a surgeon. If you want to be a primary care provider, become a nurse and become a nurse practitioner. They're just as competent. The studies show there's 93 or 94% as competent as a physician at the primary care level. So with a lot less schooling, And you can work while you're doing it.
Yeah.
So nurse practitioners are great. That's what I did. I love it. I speak highly of it. But if you want to do business, get in nursing, get an MBA, and you can climb a corporate ladder at a hospital. You can get in an organization. You can be a clinic leader. A friend of mine, he runs clinics now. He was a nurse. There's so many opportunities, but pick a pathway that you want to go and stick with it.
Interesting.
That's a great question.
I know, at least I've heard this. I don't know if it's totally true, but I've heard that doctors often tend to have, compared to other careers, have a lot more substance abuse.
Mm.
And I think probably across the board, people would say, well, it's probably because of what they're having to deal with, the stressors, everything like that. So
they also have access to all these meds.
Very true. Very right. True.
I mean, nursing, you can literally go to the machine and get the meds out.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be clever.
Yeah.
Because they track it all. I mean, literally all the provider, like Medical Association of Idaho, or excuse me, the boards, they all, pharmacist boards, medical boards, nursing boards, they all have substance abuse programs to where if you get a problem, they can help you through it before revoking your license. And there's two types of substance abuse. There's if you're stealing meds for yourself and not harming a patient, that's one category. If you're taking from your patient and harming them for your addiction, that's another category. They usually don't tolerate that. But if you're manipulating the data so you can get some meds, they'll usually help you through that. Idaho's really good about it. I've seen some nurses and some providers go through that.
That's good.
But yeah, ease of access. I mean, you got a buddy that could prescribe you something. You know, patients bring in meds. You can take a few off at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Pain management clinic, God, you can get that stuff all the time.
Yeah. Well, from hearing your stressful kind of like things you've dealt with in terms of your education and kind of your journey and all the stress that you've had to deal with, and then seeing how, you know, substance abuse is it definitely an issue in kind of those high stress jobs. What kind of tools have you found work for you in terms of managing the stress of the hospital world and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Stress is funny. Stress. Everybody has stress. If you hold on to it. Like I use this analogy with my patients. Okay, I'm going to give you a penny's worth of stress. So hold out your hand and I put a penny in their hand. I'm like, is that a lot of stress? I'm like, no. I go, now I want you to hold on to that for an hour. Is that a lot of stress? Well, what's going to happen to your arm? It's going to get tired. Mm-hmm. Hold on to it for a day. Now hold on to it for a week. Your arm's going to fall off.
Right.
Okay. What we need to learn to do is let the stress go. And that's nurses and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So the technique I use, because it's a stressful thing, I would take it home with me and I'd sit in bed and go, oh my gosh, I should have done. I got a mantra where I would think about my job on my way home to this road, this major crossroad. And at that crossroad, I put on gangster rap and I stopped thinking about it. And I forced myself to stop thinking about it. And then when I got home, it was out of mind. Rap music's in my head. And then I don't have to dwell on that in my arm. You know, I let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So you just got to learn to let it go. Counseling helps, group therapy, all that kind of stuff. And now, geez, you have apps. You pull out an app and talk to a counselor and say, hey, help me with a tool to help me let this stress go.
Right.
You got to learn how to let it go. And what most nurses do, which is why I started this podcast, is we learn to laugh about the stress.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, remember that time? That was horrible. Oh my goodness.
The fact that you mentioning that actually sparked something in me, because I remember when we would go down to the ER to do anything with them, the nurses down there had the darkest, twisted sense of humor.
How they dealt with things. You had to.
Yeah.
You had to make a joke out of it. If you didn't make a joke out of it, it was serious.
Mm-hmm.
You made a joke out of it, you laughed it off.
Right.
Laugh endorphins, serious depression, anxiety. Mm-hmm. Right. So you have to laugh it off. So anyways. Well, This has been fun.
Yeah, it's been crazy to sit down and kind of hear your side of the story.
We'll do this occasionally. Like, I got a lot more stories. We'll do this occasionally, you know, maybe, you know, once a quarter or something, and we'll just, you and I talk and have some fun. But no, it's been great. So, nurses, if you're listening and you want to get on our podcast, I don't care where you are in the world, we'll figure something out. We'll do a Zoom link or something like that. If you've got a crazy story, email it to us. What's your, do we have an email address that they can email?
Yeah, boisepodcasts, plural, so with a S, .com. Or at gmail.com.
At gmail.com. Yep. So boisepodcasts@gmail.com. Nate will get those in. If you want to come in, we'll work around your schedule. We'll figure a time where we can do this. And you can tell us your crazy stories. Mine aren't that crazy. There's so many better ones out there. So anyways, it's been great. This has been fun. We'll see you soon.
Yeah. See ya.